This is Lake Effect from Milwaukee Public Radio. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thanks so much for listening today. With Bastille Days going on in Milwaukee and the real French Independence Day coming on Monday, it's only fitting we consider France's relationship with the United States and with Wisconsin in particular. The French ambassador to the United States was in Milwaukee this spring. François Delatte was on hand as a French water consortium signed a memorandum of understanding with the Milwaukee-based Water Council. Delatte met with local and state leaders and talked about the increasing economic ties between France and Wisconsin. He also stopped by our studios as the 70th anniversary of D-Day was approaching and talked about how much of France's current relationship with the United States is still shaped by our efforts in liberating France in World War II.
I believe it's a very good question. When President François Hollande, the French president, came to the United States 2 months ago for a state visit, the first in nearly 20 years, one of his key messages that he passed together with President Obama was the values that we share, that are the core of our joint DNA, do matter in the 21st century. That's why, for example, President Hollande went to Arlington Cemetery to bestow the Legion of Honor upon 6 American veterans of World War II, expressing to them the eternal gratitude of my country. That's also why President Obama and Hollande together went to Monticello, the home of Thomas Jefferson, who very well embodies these shared values of freedom and democracy that, after all, our two countries gave the world over 200 years ago. So to answer your question, yes, these values do matter in the 21st century. That's why it's so important that President Obama will go to Normandy on June 6 for the 70th anniversary of the Normandy D-Day landings. And if you put things into perspective in the various crises we briefly mentioned, Ukraine, Syria, you know, in the tragedies, in these testing times, these values that we share are more than ever our best guide, and as I used to say, our best moral compass to confront together the current challenges we face.
Of course, since President Hollande's visit to the United States, there has been a substantial shift in the government in France. I'm curious, how is the work of an ambassador affected by a change in governance, especially a relatively sudden shift such as what France experienced in April?
The thing is that in France, and I believe in most European countries, an ambassador is not a political appointee as you understand it in this country. In other words, I'm appointed by my president, and in my case, I was appointed by former President Sarkozy, then confirmed by President Hollande, so I'm completely apolitical. So appointed by the president, but not submitted to any political agenda. I think, again, it's the case of most of my European colleagues, we represent a country and not a government per se. So in terms of the recent changes you mentioned, I believe President Hollande wanted to confirm his policy, which is to say that, number one, France has to tighten the belt, tackle our debts and deficits. That's the priority that we have. At the same time, France has to promote growth through structural reforms, reducing the cost of labor, bringing more flexibility into our labor market, lowering corporate taxes. And President Hollande went far into this direction in terms of pro-growth, pro-business measures. And that's why, by the way, the American investment to France is on the rise again. And the third priority under Franco-German leadership is to better organize, I would say, the Eurozone. Now the euro is a solid currency and unanimously considered as such. But we have to make sure that the coordination of the European social, economic, fiscal policies is stronger. And that's where François Hollande, the French president, and Angela Merkel, his German counterpart, are working very, very hard in this direction. So no revolution, in other words, but a confirmation of the pro-growth, pro-business, pro-innovation priority in France. And I would say that, as I used to say, innovation is for the country and for me as ambassador, the number one, number two, and number three priority.
Well, and within that, is there something that speaks to the place of the United States and perhaps the Midwest in particular, the importance of the economic relationship between this part of this country and the innovation that's taking place in France?
Yes, that's why I'm so happy to be here today, because obviously we have a special relationship between France and Milwaukee. This is based on our shared history and values, on Marquette and Joliet, the Alliance Française that is so active in this place. The fact that I learned that you have the longest Bastille Day celebration in the country, 4 days, that is really amazing. So that's one pillar, which is shared values and history. And at the same time, the economic partnership between France and Wisconsin is growing stronger every year. France is one of the leading foreign investors, not only in the United States, but also in Wisconsin, with more than 10,000 jobs supported in the state by French companies. More than 30 French companies are very active in Wisconsin and increasing their activities there. And that's one of the reasons why I'm here today for three key events. So to answer your question, yes, we are working on two pillars, shared values and history, but also cross-investment, job creation, innovation, and that's where the partnership between France and Wisconsin is literally booming.
One of the things that you do in representing the French, in representing France here is you also represent French culture, and I'm curious, what do you find people in this country most interested in and curious about when you speak with them?
That's a good question. I think on the cultural front, across the ups and downs of the Franco-American partnership over the last decades, you know, there has always been a very good understanding, a good partnership in this respect. In other words, culture is beyond politics. Is really at the core, I believe, of our relationship. And as I said, the Alliance Française, being so active here in Milwaukee, is a good illustration of this. You know, in the United States, you have more than 2 million people speaking French on a daily basis. So, of course, compared to the American population, it's not that huge, but it's growing, contrary to what some people can believe. And French is the second taught foreign language in American schools, which is quite amazing. And the demand for French teaching is increasing quite strongly in this country. The question for us is to be able to find the corresponding offer. In other words, the number of teachers able to teach French, but the demand for French is just booming. So I'm a very happy ambassador.
Well, and it's interesting because I was thinking about this. You are not only, you know, the ambassador of foreign policy as it's carried out and economics as they are carried out, but people must see you as representative of everything from Claude Monet to Edith Piaf to François Truffaut.
You want me to sing here, right?
Well, if you're comfortable with it.
I think your audience will regret it. No, it's true. It's true that French, I mean, the culture is really part of our DNA. It's part of what we are, what we like the most, what we want to fight for. And that's why I'm so glad that French culture and language are, thriving in the United States, that francophonie, as we say, the francophone family, is so well and alive in this country, that the demand for Alliance Française, French schools, literally from coast to coast, is booming. So it's part of, my efforts I do day after day. Yeah.
Well, Ambassador François Delattre, thank you so much. Merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you so much.
François Delattre has served as the French ambassador to the United States since 2011. He was in Milwaukee this spring to speak to a gathering of the Milwaukee Rotary Club and also met with state and local leaders at the Global Water Center, and he stopped by our studios as well. Next on the program, a multimedia art installation celebrates one of Milwaukee's iconic roadways. We'll travel to Mitchell Street when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM. I'm Mitch Tyke. There are certain streets that reflect the changing character of the neighborhoods that they traverse. Sherman Boulevard, Brady Street, and on Milwaukee's south side, historic Mitchell Street. And it was Mitchell Street that drew Milwaukee audio artist Adam Carr and photographer Sonia Thompson for their second collaborative project. The duo first worked together on a project called Here Mothers Are, melding sound and visual storytelling. They're doing the same thing in Listening to Mitchell, which has its grand opening tonight. For the next 14 weeks, Lake Effect will air audio postcards from the project on Fridays. But today, Lake Effect's Bonnie North traveled to Lopez Bakery on the corner of Mitchell and South 11th Street to talk with Carr and Thompson about the scope of the project, which actually began over coffee and pastries at Lopez Bakery.
The two of us had similar experiences on Mitchell Street about, was it 6 months after Here Mothers Are, and we kind of found ourselves interested in this street and its scale with the architecture, its history, and also its incredible diversity. It's one of the most diverse streets, I think, in Milwaukee, and it also has a fantastic pedestrian traffic. So we were intrigued with what we could do and how we could activate the street and activate people to listen to each other. I think even backtracking to Here Mothers Are, though, what we learned about our process is that because of his interest in sound and my interest in image, and then our collective interest in place, that we can really together create an experiential installation that activates multiple senses and really challenges perception of place and your perception of self in that place. And so when we came to Mitchell Street and the scale of this street and thinking about, can we actually engage someone for 8 city blocks, that was an exciting challenge. And Lopez was the place that we had coffee and kind of talked about it.
And the pastries are fabulous,
I have to say.
Yes. I have an entire bag to bring back to the office, so everyone will be happy with me with that.
But you're welcome, Mitch.
So when you first sat down and had coffee here and thought, this is something we want to do, we want to create an installation here, what came to mind? Mm-hmm. What was different about what you were doing here or what you wanted to do here as opposed to the first one?
With Here Mothers Are, we had a really great partner, the Dominican Center for Women, who had a lot of deep relationships within the neighborhood that we used and we worked with to get an introduction to the people of the neighborhood. On Mitchell Street, it was a lot less clear. I mean, this is a commercial corridor.
Yeah.
Mitchell Street, when you say that in Milwaukee, especially on the south side, it brings up memory, experience, connection, relationship. So it wasn't like, you know, we could go to the one place where all the Mitchell Street people were, because the South Side in Milwaukee are where the Mitchell Street people are. So that challenge was one that was really exciting, which was, how do we find the people connected to the place?
Our first stop was with the BID, the BID number 4, and it's right off Mitchell Street here, and Nancy Bush is the executive director of the BID. And we made contact with Nancy, and we actually presented to the board and said, we would like to engage this space, and we would like to do an installation here. And the board, that was, the first conversation was October of 2012, and the board was really excited. And so that was kind of the first push of like, okay, through this channel, we can meet business owners and kind of the current tenants on the street, and then dig into the history.
So the Business Improvement District both has that connection with business owners on the level of, okay, here are people, but also eventually we need that for displaying artworks. You know, that was actually they were instrumental in almost every place that we have a piece of making those introductions for us, and having that trusted partner on the street was super important. I mean, without that, there's no way this project could have happened. So once we had the support of the BID, we started doing interviews with business owners, and then also just kind of following the breadcrumbs of, you know, who has connections to Mitchell Street. We'd be doing one interview, and someone would come in from the next room and say, are you guys talking about Mitchell Street? And then they'd open up and all these stories would come tumbling out. Or we'd even be sitting, you know, in Lopez or in a coffee shop and, you know, we'd say, oh, we're working on this project on Mitchell, and people's eyes would get real wide and say, oh man, when I was 5, or when I was, you know, growing up, or my formative teenage years, this is what happened on Mitchell. And then we'd make an appointment with them. And it really was that kind of, you know, slow but sure process of interviews where we get more and more people. You know, Mitchell Street's such a good prompt. A lot of times people would say, oh, well, I'm not the expert on Mitchell Street, but they'd have such beautiful experience or such strong experience on the street, and they had expertise in that, you know, in their own personal experience, and that was something that we kept going to over and over.
When you were talking to all these people, did the scope of the project change as you were talking to people? Was there a different way to approach the entire thing that came to you during this process? Or did you pretty much stay with what you had envisioned?
Well, I think that I was going to add to Adam's comment there is that things got really sticky and complicated, right? A lot of nostalgia bubbled up, right? And then people romanticizing the past and thinking about, oh, it was so great, and now where is it? And we didn't want to have, like, an overly sentimental project. It wasn't about a rose-colored kind of vision. We wanted to channel what was currently there, what was there in the past, and maybe what inspire kind of conversations of what could be. So there was a lot of pushing against what people were excited to tell us, and how did we kind of steer them to different kinds of points, you know. So where do you think Mitchell Street is today was a kind of challenging question to get people, mm-hmm. instead of saying like, oh, well, nothing's going on. Then they started actually kind of, well, no, I still go there for this, or I still visit Lopez, or I still go to the Sun Fair. So things kind of became more current. Because of the commercial corridor, we were interested in the idea of material culture and how it holds memory and how people, you know, when they see something or smell something, kind of relate to place. So the initial idea was that the images would somehow reference advertising and kind of be this ad campaign in some way, but instead of selling objects, would sell these personal narratives. And that was a rough concept at the beginning, you know, 18 months ago, mm-hmm. and it's come to life. So that's really exciting that kind of carried through, although there was a huge hill of what would these images be, you know, that development. So in terms of what stayed the same, that I'm really excited that that's there. And even conversations with people on the street as we're installing them, saying, oh, I saw these pictures on 7th, and that's cool that you're putting them, so they're connecting them across the city blocks. That's really exciting.
Yeah, how many blocks does this take up in its full?
So it's from 5th to 12th. Our first piece is eastern facing on 5th, and our last piece is western facing on 12th. So that's about 7 blocks. And it's integrated into the corridor in between those streets. So, and we like to say from the Modjeska to St. Stan's, because those are two big markers on the street that people recognize. So we're on walls in storefront windows, and we're moving into stores. So there'll be artworks in all of those places throughout the corridor. And it's kind of like the idea is that it's like a treasure hunt. You know, we had a direction we wanted to go with the objects, and, you know, what would the conversations be like? What would they sound like? What would we talk about? Again, we kind of had a rough idea of where we would go, but we didn't say, here are the 20 topics we're going to talk about before we started. We were really open to having conversations, letting those go where they went, and we started seeing patterns. We started noticing that Mitchell Street was referred to in past tense a lot of times. We started noticing that there were a lot of childhood experiences, that there were a lot of very strong male narratives throughout the course of our interviews, and those became, we actually developed 20 themes that we were using to help focus both the audio of the project, but then also kind of the overall thematic approach to it. And then the sounds, we knew it would be a really wide range of voices. So when we started, we knew, okay, a wide range of voices. And then it was just a matter of finding people. And it was the people connected to the street who had a very diverse range of experiences, voices, and all that. So the question, did it change from where we started? Not a ton, and I think that's because we didn't presume that we would create, you know, frames that we're filling in.
You didn't come in with that structure already in place.
Right,
right.
Right.
We were really open to what Mitchell Street is shaping, what it sounds like, and what it looks like. And that, at times, was really, really hard. You know, like when we've been working on something for a year and you're not sure what it's going to look like yet, or you're not sure what it's going to sound like, because we really wanted to be sensitive to what's here, to be informed by the reality of this place, that at times there's a lot of trepidation in our production process. There's a lot of, you know, like, Jesus, I mean, what are we doing? We've been doing this for a year. We don't know what it looks like yet. And we just had to have faith that, you know, our process in the street would give us the answers to that.
So this is launching now. When people come down to Mitchell, what are they going to experience? If they start looking for listening to Mitchell, mm-hmm. what are they going to find?
They'll find the street, first and foremost, and they'll find themselves on the street. The images are, some are quite large, so if you enter from the 12th, you'll see a series of four images, and you'll kind of be like, what's happening here? If you enter in the east, it kind of slowly builds in terms of what you see, but they're bright images of objects.
I mean, really, it's in windows on building sides throughout the corridor.
So on empty signage.
On empty signs. So keep your eyes peeled. You know,
and
if you come
here. Is there a map? Will there be a map?
There is a map. But also, the map, even in itself, is a series of suggestions.
It's more like a treasure map, you know? So use all these prompts to find your own experience and connect the dots between images and maybe dial into the cell phone audio, listen to a story. If you come on July 11th, you're actually going to show up at 723 West Mitchell, which is the location of our site-specific audio installation.
Yeah, so on July 11th, and then until August 10th on Thursdays, Fridays, and Sundays, we have an audio installation that's going to be open on the street. So that'll give you a home base to come to experience some of this. And we've partnered with a group named Arup, who is a sound engineering firm. They do all sorts of things involving sound, from, you know, doing construction in buildings and isolating, you know, floor 13 from floors 14 and 15 to working with artists. And we're so fortunate to be working with them. And what we've done with them is taken an empty storefront at 723 Mitchell Street, and we're going to be installing 18 speakers. 18 speakers in the space. And when you walk into it,
it's an immersive sound space.
Right. There'll be these washes of sometimes chaotic, multiple voices going at once, and you'll be pulled literally in different directions trying to hear it. There'll be times where a single voice will kind of be doing a monologue, where you'll be able to hear an excerpt from an interview that we've done and hear one of these voices, one of these characters, one of these people that we've gotten to know. Really, it's hard to explain without experiencing it.
Will it change? It's not going to be on a loop?
It is, in fact, the way that we're even programming it is involving a lot of randomization. So, you know, that's actually, it echoes the entire concept of the piece, that there isn't a single truth to Mitchell Street. There isn't a single right version to Mitchell Street, because it's been the home to so many different waves of immigrants, different waves of people, businesses, cultures. You know, we couldn't say, here's the document of Mitchell Street, and part this nebula of voices really captures what the place is.
You know, the experience on the street from 12th to 5th is about getting people to kind of have a site-specific experience of place and space. And then when you go into the storefront, you're also going to be kind of pulled into the space and move to one end of the store to the other, or maybe surrounded, you know, overwhelmed. So this real visceral experience on the street and in that space. Also, if people call in and leave their own stories, the phone number is 921-2622, and if they dial #0, we're taking those stories that people share that we haven't had an opportunity to interview and mixing that into the sound space as well. So that will also create this evolution.
So it's an ongoing process for the entire length of the project.
So if you come back twice, actually if you just stay in there for a while, it's going to keep being different. You know, it's not going to be a 15-minute single experience.
Which is why it's so exciting that we're partnering with you to also feature the narratives on the radio, because that's the... When you're in your vehicle, listening to the radio is one time that you're totally immersed in listening, I feel like, you know. And so how can we have that experience on the street as well as throughout the city?
Well, briefly talk about the little things that we're going to be running over 14 weeks. Mm-hmm. On Fridays, we're going to have this Listening to Mitchell piece that's specifically for the radio and for Lake Effect.
Right. And we've created a 20-part cell phone guide that has different mixes and some solo voices in them. But one of the things we found while editing it is that on a cell phone or on a phone receiver, it's hard to hear the nuances, the subtlety of voices, and it's also just hard to do some of the cool things you can do with radio, or presuming the audience is hearing it from a very clear sound source. So we're going to be taking some of those cell phone pieces that we've made that are mixes, some of them monologues, some of the stories, and presenting those.
So those are starting next week. Yes.
Yes.
Perfect. Sonia and Adam, it has been great to kind of catch up with you guys again. It's always good to talk to you both, but this is a fantastic project.
Thank you.
Thanks
and this,
so much.
This table where we're sitting would be a great place for an audience member to see Mitchell Street. There's a bus stop here. There's a lot of car traffic here. You can kind of see firsthand what the street looks like sitting in Lopez Bakery.
Right.
Having a delicious treat.
I was going to say, and the tastes of Mitchell. That's
exactly.
The other part.
Exactly.
Because you just look at the case over there, and it's drool-inducing.
It
so, well, thank you both so much for coming out. I know it's a hardship to come to Lopez Bakery, but I appreciate you making that sacrifice for us.
Thank you, Bonnie.
Thanks, Bonnie.
Adam Carr and Sonia Thompson are the creators of Listening to Mitchell, a multimedia art installation along 7 blocks of Mitchell Street that opens tonight. They spoke with Bonnie North. Lake Effect will air audio postcards from the project beginning next week. Another break now, and in just a moment, if you were hoping for garden fresh produce this year but haven't planted anything yet, don't despair. We'll find out what can still go in the ground today and come out this season when Lake Effect returns on WUWN. More of Lake Effect Now, I'm Mitch Teich. It's already into mid-July, a time when we might normally be talking about the imminent harvest of fruits and vegetables from trees and gardens around Wisconsin. And while some of that is going on, witness the bumper crop of strawberries, the delayed spring and summer weather has changed some of the growing paradigm. In fact, our gardening contributor Melinda Meyer says it's not too late even to be talking about putting things into the ground.
I don't want people giving up because they feel like, well, it's July and I can't plant. Still plenty of time. The good news from an edible standpoint is a lot of plants like broccoli and cauliflower and cabbage actually taste better when harvested in the fall. The same goes with peas. I travel a lot in the spring, so a lot of times I don't get those cool season crops in till midsummer, so I'm harvesting in the fall and the flavor's better. So procrastination does pay in some cases. Here's the key to success. You're at the seed counter, you have some seeds you saved from last year. Look at the back of the packet or the tag on a transplant. It will tell you how many days to harvest. So you figure it's the middle of July. We typically, depends on how optimistic you are, have till the middle of October till our first killing frost. So that's August, September, October. That's about 3 months or 90 days. So if you look at the back of the seed packet, like cucumbers take about 65 days. Planting them now, you'll have plenty of time for them to grow, develop, and harvest. And you might even want to push your luck with some things that maybe would be nipped by frost and say, I'll cover them with floating row cover. So don't give up. Don't feel like, you know what, I missed my opportunity to plant. And you may even find a few deals in the garden center as well.
Let me ask a dumb question. You find seeds there, you know, in your workshop or what have you. How long can seeds sit around and still be good?
You know, it varies with the type of seed and how they've been stored. I always keep a Tupperware in my refrigerator and stick my, you know, a rubber container or a glass jar, put my seeds in there in the refrigerator. That consistent temperature really helps them last longer. You can do a fun trick if you're a little skeptical. Take 10 seeds, fold them up in a damp paper towel, and put them in a baggie. Keep them in a warm, dark place, and then check in a week. If all of them sprout, you've got 100% germination. You can plant according to the seed packet. If half of them sprout, you've got 50%. So double it up and thicken it up a little bit. And you can even plant those that you sprouted already so you don't lose that week. You just get a head start with those that you sprouted. So it's a great question. The better we store them, the longer lasting they are. And I always think, you know, we buy packets of seeds. I'm notorious, and I don't always get everything planted, and that's why I have a big collection of seeds that then I'm like, oh, what do I have in the refrigerator? Oh, that'll be fun to try.
Well, and so let me play reality check here. And you kind of spoke to this. Just because the growing season got off to a late start, that does not necessarily mean that it will run longer than usual. So we do have to be cognizant of these growing periods.
You bet. You know, I think I heard everybody say a really cold winter, we're going to have a really hot summer. And I think some of us are still waiting for that. And we may not have a late frost, but we could have an early killing frost. So you want to go with the average. I've been gardening here for over 30 years, and I remember a late September frost, and I've remembered some late into November even before we had a killing frost. And so it's really out of our control, but we can do some things. You know, floating row covers, cold frames to extend the season, or, you know, well, I'm done gardening, and sometimes a killing frost just ends the season and goes, next year will be better.
My allergies will go away.
Exactly. Another positive.
Well, you mentioned things that we grow for food, cucumbers, peas, broccoli. But what about putting things in for the sake of color? What are the best bets to look at?
You know, one of the great things garden centers are doing now is they've got larger size annuals. So they've got great replacements available for us. So you didn't get your annuals in, or they didn't do quite as well, or boy, that perennial just didn't pull through like I thought it would. And so they've got some larger plants that you can put right in the ground, bigger size, give you good impact right away, or create a container. One friend of mine who manages a botanical garden said they were really struggling, and so they went out and bought a bunch of hanging baskets and planters and put the whole thing in the garden so it looked like it was growing there. Not trying to trick their visitors, just trying to add some color where it was needed. Plus, perennials, trees and shrubs, you can plant them anytime during the growing season. The key is proper care after planting. If we get that really hot weather that's typical in late July and August, you just need to make sure those new plantings get properly watered, mulch the soil to conserve moisture. And you know what? Sometimes you get things on sale. Sometimes the selection may not be as good as it was in early May, but the deals you get are better. And if you have time now versus in May when you were struggling with the weather, it's a great time to kind of perk up your garden, add a little color, add a little pizzazz. And I think we've got a lot of growing season and outdoor time to enjoy, and we want it to be beautiful as well.
Well, and along the lines of things that you can plant anytime, what about herbs, things like, you know, basil, parsley, and other things along those lines? Can those go in at any point?
You bet. If you can find the plants, great. If you've got seeds, you may want to put them in pots so that you can bring them in the fall, because it's great to do a windowsill herb garden or take cuttings as well. Perennial herbs, definitely time to put those in the garden. And so if you can find the plants and they're looking good, it's a great time to add them. As soon as they get rooted in a couple weeks, you can start taking a few clippings to add and use for your meals.
And these are the kinds of things that you often run into if you go to a farmer's market.
Exactly. And farmer's markets are great places. They are starting to harvest some things so you can get fresh produce. It's a great place to try vegetables that you're considering growing. You know, I say try them at the farmer's market. If you like them, then you know it's worth the space.
It takes a lot to commit to heirloom turnips.
Exactly, exactly. And so that space is pretty precious, especially if you're a small space gardener in your time. So it's a way to test it and see. Sweet corn is wonderful, takes up a lot of room. Let the farmers grow that as my voice. And then I'm going to save space for things like the tomatoes I love and the peppers. If you have room, corn is fun as well. And the other thing to do is if you're canning or freezing, you know, sometimes going to the farmer's market is a great way because you go, okay, I've got time this weekend. I'm going to go Saturday, stock up on my tomatoes. I'm going to make my sauces and do all of that. Because sometimes our gardens ripen and it's harvest time when we really don't have the time to can and freeze. And so you can always share it with food pantries in the area as well.
Well, so finally, let me ask you a question ripped from the headlines, at least ripped from the headlines in the Tyke household. We spent a lot of time weeding this spring. The weeds were great. They did wonderfully. Ripped out a whole bunch of weeds, put down an organic corn gluten-based weed killer, and made sure we watered it so that it would get into the soil, put down mulch to try to further inhibit the weeds. The weeds are now coming up through the mulch. What's the course of action that one takes when one's weeds are making their way through the mulch?
Yeah, and you know what? It doesn't matter how bad the growing season, the weeds always thrive, right? So a couple things. The corn gluten meal is an excellent pre-emergent, great for lawns, good in the garden. Timing is critical. It sounds like you did it right. It prevents the seeds from germinating. But if you've got perennial weeds, quackgrass, bindweed, creeping charlie, it will help with the seeds, but it won't kill the existing plants. And if you've ever tilled up a garden that had quackgrass, that's what I have now, thousands of rhizomes, those white root light things. And every time you cut them up, if you don't get them out of the garden, you're starting more plants. So it's continual effort. So corn gluten meal has had good results, reducing weeds by up to 80% in lawns. I haven't seen the statistics for gardens, but it does take a couple of years. And the mulch, excellent. A lot of research has shown that that's just as effective as pre-emergent. So what you may want to do is pull those perennial weeds. There are some natural weed killers out there, grass and weed killers. They use soap and they burn the top. But you have to keep doing it because those roots will keep shooting
up more leaves. Can you put that right down through the mulch?
Well, when the weeds come through, just spot treat. And that's a good organic product. You'll have to keep doing it. But eventually, you kill the tops and the plants starve to death, basically. So if you can keep after it. And it's a good organic option.
Melinda Myers, thanks so much.
Thank you, Mitch.
Melinda Myers is our gardening contributor. She's host of Melinda's Garden Moments on television and author of numerous books on gardening, including the Midwest Gardener's Handbook. In fact, you can find out how to win copies of some of her latest titles by visiting wuwm.com/contests. One last break, and then a new concert series tries to change Milwaukee's live music experience. We'll learn more when Lake Effect returns on Milwaukee Public Radio. Lake Effect continues on WUWM, Milwaukee Public Radio now. I'm Mitch Tyke. So it's about to be Friday night, and you're heading out to see some local musical talent. That's not unusual, except in this case, the venue is a house, or more specifically, someone's living room. And the patrons have all been asked to bring their own beer, to stay quiet and attentive through the performance, and to leave their cell phones behind. And lastly, no one even knows who's performing until they arrive. It's all part of a concert series called So Far Sounds, which has been catching fire since it began 5 years ago in London, started by a group of friends who were tired of loud venues and crowds more engrossed with their phones than the music. So Far Sounds now exists in more than 86 cities around the world. Milwaukee is its latest location thanks to coordinators Lizzie Altman and Chandra Rudolph. They stopped by the WUWM studio to talk with Rachel Owens, and Rudolph explained a bit more about the series' origins.
A lot of times when people go to concerts or whatnot, they're overpowered by the crowd who's there to chat with their friends or to, get wasted and, have a good time, which is nice and all, and that's a great reason to go to a concert. But these friends were kind of frustrated that they couldn't pay attention to the musicians in front of them and that the crowd wasn't really respecting the fact that there were people on stage, trying to make a living and trying to bring something beautiful to the world, and everybody else was just kind of like steamrolling it. So basically they invited their musician friends to come to their flat and play a show, and it was a really big hit, and they're like, you know what? This would be really cool if we could bring this to other towns and cities. And it's basically, started off in London, and in, less than 5 years, it's now in 86 cities globally. So it's a pretty cool thing, and we're really excited to bring it to Milwaukee because, I was surprised it wasn't already here, because I feel like this town would really embrace something like this.
What about Milwaukee do you think makes it a great fit?
There is just so much music here. Like before, I just moved back to Milwaukee. I'm from here, but I was living and traveling elsewhere. I moved back a couple of years ago, and I had no idea just the wealth of music and the breadth of music that is in this town. So, like, from everything from pop and reggae and funk and bluegrass, so...
I agree. I actually am not from Milwaukee, and I moved here 2 years ago, but had been blogging about music in Chicago. And so when I came here, I wanted to learn more about Milwaukee musicians. And, I had to, make my own way, figure out what clubs played good music and whatnot. And this, for me and for anybody else who's a transplant here and who doesn't know the Milwaukee scene, I feel like So Far Sound will be a really great introduction to see, the local musicians that we have here.
This is all volunteer run, right?
That's correct. Yep. Mm-hmm. The whole organization is completely volunteer-run. We're a nonprofit. We don't charge anything at the door. It's a really great experience for the people who come to attend. For the bands, we offer them our global fan base. So we're going to be recording the show that night and putting together really well-done music videos for the bands as our payment to them. So it's pretty well-rounded in that respect that, you know, everybody's there just to celebrate music.
Seems like there's a lot of, you know, in the kind of DIY scene going on, there have been a lot of living room concert series. There have been the Tiny Desk concerts at NPR, that sort of thing.
Yeah.
How do you feel this series is either similar or distinct from those other movements?
Well, I think it's similar in the sense that, as Chandra said, it's just about connecting people who love music. But what's so exciting for us about so far is that it's done on this global scale. So Milwaukee is going to be represented right next to Portland and Chicago and London and Buenos Aires and Berlin. And so it's just a way to kind of catapult our amazing community of musicians here to this international stage and international music lovers who wouldn't maybe hear their music otherwise.
Mm-hmm. What I also like about it is that it is open to the public. Even though it's secret and whatnot, as long as you sign up for our global mailing list, you'll know when the date is. And we'll try to get as many people through that door. So if someone isn't able to come this time, we'll have them come in August or in September. Like, we're going to try to make sure everybody's there. And, you know, it's fun to watch the Tiny Concert Desk series online, but we're not in the NPR office in D.C. to be there personally. We actually get to show up and be like inches away from the musicians, and they're going to be a part of the crowd too. They're going to watch the other bands play and going to be available to talk to the audience members. It's just a really intimate experience that you couldn't have in an actual venue or elsewhere.
Looking at the YouTube videos online, it seems like also the spaces that these concerts are held in are so unique and so different, and they add so much to the atmosphere. So how do you choose which living room or whose place?
Well, we're looking for a space that can, number one, hold the capacity of crowd that we hope to bring out to the shows, anywhere from, what do we usually aim for, 40 to 100?
Mm-hmm.
So space is, you know, the actual space of the living room is key. But yeah, then just kind of funky, quirky locations, places, you know, that are easily accessible to anyone in the Milwaukee area. And am I missing anything?
No, that's we want to scatter them. There won't be in the same location month after month. The location will change, the environment will change, and that will add to the, you know, intimacy of the night.
Are the musicians really looking forward to it, the bands that you have lined up so far?
I think so, yeah.
I hope so. I think this is the first time we're throwing this event here, and it's new to the entire audience and to the bands. They're all first time so far players. So it's exciting for them in a lot of ways. I also think they're like, what have we gotten ourselves into? You know, we've just kind of been selling this to all of our friends and acquaintances and the bands. So we're hoping for an awesome show. And I think everyone will be blown away.
Why keep the band secret till the last minute?
I think it's, at least the way I look at it, it's a way to get audiences out and for the audience members themselves to come out to see music that they wouldn't necessarily ever encounter on their own. You know, so someone who doesn't know much about, say, bluegrass, for example, they don't know when they go out to see a So Far show if that's going to be one of kind of the featured items on the menu, to put it that way. So, yeah, I think it's a way to just broaden people's musical horizons. And it just adds like a level of excitement when you don't, you know, you sign up to come and you're giving 2 hours of your time and you don't know what you're in store for.
I think another reason why it's fun to keep them secretive is that we have the opportunity to give people an audience that everybody doesn't know what to expect. So sometimes, like, when you come to a concert, you'll have, like, girls next to you singing along, and that kind of can interrupt your enjoyment of the concert. And here, we're not going to have, like, super fans of any of the bands there. We're not going to have people show up, you know, an hour late because they know their band's not going on until, you know, the third act. You know, it's everybody's coming there. There's no headliners. We're coming there to enjoy all of the music, and it doesn't matter what their name is or that you've seen their YouTube videos 15 times before you went there. It's a complete surprise, and hopefully a pleasant surprise to everybody who comes.
Audience participation, clapping, that kind of thing encouraged, or?
Clapping's fine.
We do have some rules, and one of the rules is to, you know, pay attention and to support the bands. So clapping is definitely fine, but there is the don't talk during the show. But a lot of the bands are like, you know what, I need your help in this song. You're going to sing part of this, and I'm going to teach you it. And then now we have like some choral I forget the word going, but basically there is audience participation in that respect, but we leave that to the bands to decide on how they want the audience to participate with them.
And just logistically speaking, how does it change the way that a band needs to come and prepare for a gig?
Well, all of our shows are basically unmiked. We will be recording them, so there are mics set up for the recording equipment, but they're intimate enough that we don't need to have vocal mics on the artist or have amps on all of the instruments. So it'll be an unplugged, intimate show in that respect. Which means that you'll see some bands who might be really loud or crazy out in public or, you know, at any concert venue, and you might see them change their setup a little bit to kind of accommodate our concept. But in some ways, that's really cool because this might be the only way, except for maybe going to their practice space, to see them in that light.
And I would just say, too, as a musician myself, I just, you know, writing songs, I love for people to hear the lyrics and to hear the words. And so, like with what Chandra's saying, having it kind of stripped down, having it more acoustically focused is a great way for musicians to share their lyrics and for audiences to get to hear some of that kind of the artistry that goes into a song that when you're at a really loud venue and, you know, rocking out, you don't always get that, so.
And then on top of that, I assume that there's no cell phones and videotaping and that sort of thing allowed.
No. Yeah. I mean, we will encourage people to take pictures and to post it on social media, but we definitely want them during the performance to be paying attention and to giving that attention to the musicians that they don't get elsewhere.
So how does someone go about signing up for this? How does someone actually attend the first concert happening on Friday?
Well, we have, you can visit www.sofarsounds.com, and Milwaukee is one of the cities now listed up on the Attend a Show. It's a really long list, but you can find us alphabetically in there, and you can sign up to get updates about when we will be having shows in Milwaukee. We also have our own Facebook page, So Far Sounds Milwaukee. We post a lot of little tidbits and teasers there, and Twitter, and
these are going to be year round.
Yeah,
we're hoping. Yeah, we're planning.
It sounds like you're having a really strong response so far.
Yeah, I would say the show is definitely going to be sold out. We have a few more spots left.
And it's also bring your own beverage, I understand.
It is. I love that. I think that's great for Milwaukee. It's fun to like have a BYOB event where you can bring whatever you care to bring. You know, we're not expecting people to get wasted or drunk at these events, but we want them to have a good time. So I think it'll be a fun concept. You're going to be camped out next to other people and patrons, and we hope that everybody who's there starts to mingle with each other, too. It's not a normal concert where you're there with just your buddies. We want people to create connections as well.
And like you said, there's the opportunity for the artist to speak with the audience and maybe just hang out afterwards, and it just kind of turns into an after party, it seems like.
Absolutely. When I went to my first So Far concert just this past May in Chicago, I was sitting before the show next to someone who turned out for the third band that was about to go play. He got up to go on the, you know, in the front of the room on the stage, more or less. So I'd been talking with him and hadn't even realized, like, wow, this is a guy in one of these amazing bands. And I got to meet, like, a lot of the different bands afterwards and buy CDs and talk to them about their upcoming shows. So it's definitely, it's putting musicians and, like, music-loving audiences together in a unique way.
I also saw that on a YouTube video that also some people were performing poetry. Is there also that opportunity here in Milwaukee, or have you not come to that yet?
We won't have any poetry at our first show, but yeah, we've talked to people who are more done like beatboxing or rap and stuff like that. There's definitely the opportunity for something in artistic performance besides music. I think the book is open on this. We can do whatever the audience craves or what our community craves.
Well, it's so great to have you both in here, and good luck with the first concert. We really look forward to having that here in Milwaukee.
Thank you so much for having us in.
Thank you.
Lizzie Altman is a local musician, part of Calamity Janes and the Frattney Street Band. Chandra Rudolph is a writer and the editor and co-founder at Milwaukee's Secret Note Productions. They're co-coordinators of So Far Sounds Milwaukee, which launches tonight at 7 p.m. They spoke with Rachel Owens. You can learn how to get on the invite list from a link at wuwm.com/lakeeffect. That's the Friday edition of Lake Effect. We're produced by Bonnie North, Dan Harmon, and Stephanie Lecce, with web assistance from Michelle Maternowski, studio engineering from John Strelecki, and production assistance from Brooke Dowden, Eleanor Peterson, and Audrey Nowakowski. I'm Mitch Tyke. Thank you so much for tuning in today, and I do hope you'll be with us again tomorrow and Sunday afternoon at 3 for Lake Effect Weekend from 89.7 WUWM Milwaukee Public Radio. We're NPR in Milwaukee. Have yourself a great weekend. Stay tuned. It's 11 o'clock, and Fresh Air is next. Thank you.